and called to say the same two bagmen hadn't been answering their phones for some time, and their car wasn't where it should be, so accordingly, word had gone out to the taxi fleet with a description of the car, which for once had gotten an instant response. Two separate drivers said the exact same thing. Some time ago they had seen a car just like that getting a tow, rear wheels off the ground behind a medium-sized tow truck. Three silhouettes in the tow truck's cab. At first Gregory thought nothing of it. Cars broke down. Then he asked, but why would that stop them answering their phones? In his head, he heard Dino's voice. We have a guy at the car crushing plant. He owes us money, too. Out loud, he said, he's making it 4 for 2, not 2 for 2. He must have lost his mind. His guy said, the restaurant block is worth less than the money lending. Perhaps that's the message. What is he now, a CPA? He can't afford to look weak. Neither can I. 4 for 2 is bullshit. Put the word out. I want 2 more of his by morning. Make it decorative this time. Reacher made the right and the left and came up on a sturdy triangle of 3 high-rise hotels, all national mid-market chains, 2 of them east of Center Street and 1 of them west. He picked one out at random and spent 5 whole minutes of his life at its front desk, using his passport as his photo ID and his ATM card as his preferred method of payment, and then signing his name 2 times in 2 different places on 2 different lines for 2 different reasons. He had gotten into the Pentagon easier back in the day. He took a city map from the lobby and rode up to his room, which was a plain, bland space with nothing to commend it, but it had a bed and a bathroom, which were all he needed. He sat on the bed to look at the map. The city was shaped like a pear, gridded out with streets and avenues, pulling upward at the top toward the distant highway. The Ford dealer and the agricultural machinery would be right at the tip where the stock would be. The hotels were plumb in the middle of the fat part, the business district. There was an art gallery and a museum. The development with the Shevik House was halfway to the eastern limit. On the map, it looked like a tiny squared-up thumbprint. Where would a very smart and very rich guy choose to lie low? Nowhere. That was Reacher's conclusion. The city was big, but not big enough. The guy had been famous. He had employed a senior vice president for communications. Everyone was talking about him. Presumably his picture had been in the paper all the time. Could such a person become an instant overnight hermit? Not possible. The guy had to eat, at least. He had to go out and get food, or have it brought to him. Either way, people would see him. They would recognize him. They would talk. A week later, there would be bus tours to his house. Unless the guys who brought him food didn't talk. The population of Ukraine was about 45 million. Some of them had come to America. No reason to believe they all knew each other. No reason to assume a connection. But a connection was the only way for a person to hide in a city that size. The only guarantee of success was to be concealed and protected and catered to by a loyal and vigilant force, like a secret agent in a safe house, staring longingly out a window while discreet couriers came and went. 7 chances before the week is over, he thought. He folded the map and jammed it in his back pocket. He rode down to the lobby and stepped out to the street. He was hungry. He hadn't eaten since lunch with the Sheviks. A chicken salad sandwich, a bag of potato chips, and a can of soda. Not much, and a long time ago. He turned and walked on Center Street, and within a block and a half he realized that in terms of food service, most places were already closed. It was already too late in the evening, which was okay. He didn't want most places. He walked north on Center to where, in his mind's eye, the fat part of the pear began to thin, and then he turned back south and sat on a bus bench and watched the ebb and flow in front of him. It was a slow-motion exercise. Mostly the place was empty. There were long, quiet gaps between vehicles. Pedestrians came and went, often in groups of four or five, which, based on age and appearance, were sometimes the last restaurant parties letting out and heading home, and sometimes the first fashionably late arrivals at whichever establishments were newly cool, which seemed to be split about 50-50 east and west of center, judging by the general drift, which was actually more than a drift. There was some energy in it, some attraction. Also heading in one direction or the other was the occasional loner. A man, every time. Some of them looking down at the sidewalk, some of them staring rigidly ahead, as if embarrassed to be seen. All of them anxious to get where they were going. Reacher got up off the bus bench and followed the drift to the east. Up ahead he saw a glamorous quartet pass through a door on the right. When he got there, he saw a bar dressed up to look like a federal prison. The bartenders were wearing orange jumpsuits. The only staff member not in costume was a big guy on a stool inside the door. He was wearing black pants and a black shirt. He had black hair. Albanian, almost certainly. Reacher knew that part of the world. He had spent time there. The guy looked like a recent transplant. He had a smug look on his face. He had power. And he enjoyed it. Reacher drifted onward. He followed a furtive but determined man around a corner and saw him go in an unmarked door, just as another man came out, all red in the face and happy. Gambling, Reacher thought, not prostitution. He knew the difference. He had been an MP 13 years. He guessed the guy going in thought he was about to win back what he lost yesterday, and the guy coming out had just won enough to pay his debts, with enough left over for a bouquet of flowers and dinner for two. Unless fate would be better served by continuing the winning streak. It was a tough decision, almost a moral choice. What was a guy to do? Reacher watched. The guy opted for flowers and dinner. Reacher drifted onward. Albanian collections tended to be made later in the evening, because their scene tended to start later, which meant registers filled later. Their method was completely different than on the other side of Center Street. They didn't go inside. No menacing presence, no dark suits, no black silk ties. They stayed in the car. They had been asked not to upset the various clientels of the various establishments they serviced. They could be mistaken for cops or agents of some other kind. Bad for business. In no one's interest. Instead, a runner would bring out the envelope, hand it through the car window, and duck back inside. Thousands of dollars for a ride around the block. Nice work if you could get it. Two blocks east and one block north of the gambling club Reacher had seen was a trio of side-by-side establishments, all owned by the same family. First, a bar, then an open-all-night convenience store, and in third place, a liquor store. Their contributions were collected by a veteran pair, both retired leg breakers, both much respected. They had a practiced rhythm for driving from door to door. It was about 30 feet from one to the next. One guy drove, and the other guy sat behind him. Their preferred method. The far back window was down 2 inches. The envelope was passed into a void. No contact, nothing too close. Then the pedal was blipped, and a sluggish surge through the transmission propelled the car 30 feet to the next door, where an envelope was passed into a void, and so on. Except that night, at the third stop outside the liquor store, it wasn't an envelope. It was a fat black suppressor on the end of a gun. Chapter 13. The gun was a Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine gun, and evidently it was set to fire threes, because that was what the guy in the back of the car received, aimed blind but smart, slightly back, stitching low to medium, hoping for legs and arms and maybe his chest. Meanwhile, the driver was getting much the same thing from the other side, but mostly to his head, through the shattering glass, from another H&K, dancing in from the opposite sidewalk. After which the car's doors were wrenched open, almost symmetrically, the guy from the far sidewalk shoving the driver into the empty seat alongside him and taking his place, while the guy from the liquor store crowded in the back. They slammed their doors and the car took off, all its seats filled, its occupants arranged diagonally. Two guys feeling pretty good about things, plus one guy dead and one guy dying. By that time, Reacher was two blocks the other side of Center Street. He had figured out the demarcation line between Albanian and Ukrainian territory. He had found exactly what he was looking for. He was in a bar with small round cabaret tables and a stage in back. On the stage was a guitar-bass drums trio, and on the tables were late-night small-bite menus. There was an espresso machine on the bar back. There was a guy on a stool inside the door. Black suit, white shirt, black tie, white skin, fair hair. Ukrainian for sure. All good, Reacher thought. Everything he needed, and nothing he didn't. He chose a table on the far side of the room, about halfway in, and he sat with his back to the wall. In the left corner of his eye was the guy on the stool, and in the right corner was the band. They were pretty good. They were playing blues covers in a 1950s jazz style. Soft, round tones from the guitar, not too loud. Woody thumps from the bass, brushes skittering over the snare drum. No vocals. Most of the crowd was drinking wine. Some had pizzas about the size of a teacup saucer. Reacher checked the menu. They were called personal size, plain or pepperoni. $9. A waitress came by. She fit the 1950s music. She was petite and gamine, maybe in her late 20s, neat and slender and dressed all in black, with short dark hair and lively eyes and a shy but contagious smile. She could have been in an old-time black-and-white movie with jazz on the soundtrack. Probably someone's sassy little sister, dangerously advanced. Probably wanted to wear pants to the office. Reacher liked her. She said, "May I bring you something?" Reacher ordered two glasses of tap water, two double espressos, and two pepperoni pizzas. She asked, "Is someone joining you?" "I'm worried about malnutrition," he said. She smiled and left, and the band kicked into a mournful rendition of Howlin' Wolf's old song, Killing Floor. The guitar took the vocal line, with a tumble of pearl-like notes explaining how he should have quit her since his second time and went on to Mexico. At the door, people kept on coming in, always two or more together, never alone. They all paused a second, like Reacher had before, obediently, for the doorman's scrutiny. He looked at them one by one, up and down and in the eye, and he moved them inside with a millimetric jerk of his head toward the fun beyond his shoulder. They walked past him, and he crossed his arms and slumped back on his stool. Two songs later, the waitress brought his food. She set it all out. He said thank you. She said he was welcome. He said, "Does the guy at the door ever stop anyone coming in?" "Depends who they are," she said. "Who does he stop?" "Cops. Although we haven't seen cops in here for years." "Why cops?" "Never a good idea. Whatever happens, if the wind changes, suddenly it's bribery or corruption or entrapment or some other big thing. That's why cops have their own bars." "Therefore, he hasn't stopped anyone coming in for years. Now I'm wondering what he's for exactly."
"Why are you asking?"
"I'm curious," Reacher said.
"Are you a cop?"
"Next you're going to tell me I look like your dad."
She smiled. "He's much smaller," she said.
She turned away with a last look, which was not a wink, but it was close. Then she was gone. The band played on. The guy at the door was counting, Reacher figured. He was a cuckoo in the nest. Most likely the protection money was on a percentage basis. The guy counted the crowd so the owners couldn't fudge the numbers. Plus, maybe he offered a nominal security presence to sweeten the deal. so everyone felt better. The waitress came back before Reacher was finished. She had his check in a black vinyl wallet. She was about to go off duty. He rounded it up and added 10 for a tip and paid in cash. She left. He finished his meal, but stayed at his table a moment, watching the guy at the door. Then he got up and walked toward him. No other way to leave the restaurant. In the door, out the door. He stopped level with the stool. He said, "I have an urgent message from Maxim Trulenko. I need you to figure out a way to get it to him. I'll be here tomorrow, same time." Then he moved onward, out the door to the street. 20 feet away on his right, the waitress came out the staff-only door at the exact same moment, which he hadn't expected. She stopped on the sidewalk, petite, gamine, going off duty. She said, "Hi." He said, "Thanks again for looking after me, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your evening." He was counting time in his head. She said, "You too, and thank you for the very nice tip." She stayed about 7 feet away, a little tense, a little up on her toes, all kinds of body language going on. He said, "I try to think what kind of tip I would like if I was a waitress. That's an image I'll never unsee." He was counting time in his head because one of two things was about to happen. Either nothing or something. Maybe nothing. Because maybe Maxim Trulenko's name meant nothing to them. Or maybe something. Because maybe Trulenko's name was top of the list of their VIP clients. Time would tell. The waitress asked, "So what are you, if you're not a cop?" "I'm between jobs right now." If Trulenko's name was on a list, the likely protocol would be for the guy at the door to call it in or text it in immediately. And then, either because of an instruction in an immediate response, or because it was part of the protocol anyway, he would come out to detain and delay any way he could, at least long enough to snap a picture with his phone, hopefully long enough for a roving surveillance team to show up, or a roving snatch squad. No doubt they had plenty of vehicles, and not a huge patch to patrol. Half of a pear-shaped city. "I'm sorry about your situation," the waitress said. "I hope you find something soon." "Thank you," Reacher said. It would take the guy inside maybe 40 seconds to make the call, or to text back and forth, and then get set, and take a breath, and step out the door behind them. In which case, he was due right about then. If it was something. Maybe it was nothing. The waitress asked, "What kind of work do you like to do?" The guy stepped out the door behind them. Reacher moved to the curb and turned around to make a shallow triangle with the waitress now on his left and the guy on his right and empty space at his back. The guy looked at Reacher, but spoke to the waitress. He said, "Run along now, kid." Reacher glanced at her. She mouthed something at him. Could have been, "Watch where I go." Then she ran along. Not literally. She turned and crossed the street at a brisk walk, and Reacher glanced over his shoulder twice, just briefly, not long between, like frames from a video, the first of which showed her already half a block away, striding north on the far sidewalk, and the second of which showed her gone completely, through a doorway, therefore, toward the end of the block. The guy on his right said, "I would need your name before I could put you in touch with Max Trulenko. And maybe first we should talk it through, you and me, about how you came to know him, just to put his mind at rest." "When could we do that?" Reacher asked. "We could do that right now," the guy said. "Come inside. I'll buy you a cup of coffee." Detain and delay, Reacher thought, until the snatch squad showed up. He looked left and right along the street. No headlights. Nothing coming. Not yet. He said, "Thanks, but I just had dinner. I'm all set. I'll come back tomorrow, about the same time." The guy took out his phone. "I could text him your photo," he said, "as a first step. That would be quicker." "No, thanks," Reacher said. "I need you to tell me how you know Max." "Everyone knows Max. He was famous here for a spell." Tell me the message you have for him. His ears only, Reacher said. The guy didn't answer. Reacher checked the street, both ends. Nothing coming. Not yet. The guy said, We shouldn't get off on the wrong foot. Any friend of Max's is a friend of mine. But if you know Max, obviously you know we have to check you out. You wouldn't want anything less for him. Reacher checked the street. Now there was something coming. There was a pair of bucking, bouncing headlight beams coming around the southwest corner of the block, faster than the front suspension could comfortably handle. They swept and dipped and settled straight and then rose up high as the rear end of the car squatted down under heavy acceleration. Straight at them. I'll see you again, Reacher said. I hope. He turned and crossed the street and went north, away from the car, and saw a second car coming around the northwest corner of the block. Same bouncing headlight beams, from the other direction. Heavy acceleration. Straight at him. Probably two guys in each car. Decent numbers, and their response time was quick. They were on DEFCON 1. Therefore, Trulenko was important. Therefore, their rules of engagement would be pretty much whatever they wanted them to be. Right then, Reacher was the meat in a bright light sandwich. Watch where I go. A doorway, toward the end of the block. He turned around, hunching away from the light, and he saw one doorway after another, looming up out of the jagged moving shadows. Most of the doors belonged to retail operations, with nothing but dusty gray dimness inside, like closed stores everywhere, and some of the doors were plainer and stoutly made of wood, presumably for private quarters above. But none of them were open, not even a tempting inch, and none of them had a rim of light around the frame. He moved north, because the waitress had been going north, and the shadows gave up more doors, one by one, but they were all the same as before, mute and gray and stubbornly closed. The cars came closer. Their lights got brighter. Reacher gave up on doorways. He figured he had misheard, or misread her lips. At that point, his brain started cycling through scenarios involving two guys from the south and two from the north. No doubt all four of them armed, although probably not with shotguns, so close to downtown. Therefore, handguns only, possibly suppressed, depending on their de facto arrangement with the local police department, as in, don't frighten the voters. But against any instinct toward caution would be extreme reluctance to disappoint their bosses. The cars slowed to a stop. Reacher was pinned right in the middle. Rule 1, set in stone since he was a tiny kid, back when he first realized he could be either frightened or frightening, was to run toward danger, not away from it. Which right then gave him his pick of forward or backward. He chose forward, north, the way he was already going. No break in his stride, no reversal of momentum, faster and harder. Glare ahead of him and glare behind him. He kept on going, instinctive, but also sound tactics, as sound as they could be under the dismal circumstances, in the sense of making the best of a very bad hand. He was distorting the picture, at least, what the pointy heads would call altering the battle space. The guys ahead would feel mounting pressure the closer he got. The guys behind would have longer shots. Both conditions would impair efficiency, ultimately below 50% with a bit of luck, because the guys behind would worry about friendly fire. Their buddies up ahead were right next to the target. The guys behind might take themselves out of the fight voluntarily, making the best of a very bad hand. Reacher hustled onward. He heard car doors open. On his left, as he hustled, he saw retail store doorways jumping in and out of the headlight shadows, one by one, all of them mean and closed tight. Until one of them wasn't. Because it wasn't a doorway. It was an alley. On his right, the traffic curb was unbroken, but on his left, there was a gloomy 8-foot gap between buildings, paved the same way as the municipal sidewalk. A pedestrian thoroughfare of some kind. Public. Leading where? He didn't care. It was dark. It was guaranteed to let out somewhere a whole lot better than an empty street lit up bright by four headlight beams from two face-to-face automobiles. He ducked into the alley. He heard footsteps start behind him. He hustled on. The depth of a building later, the alley widened out to a narrow street, still dark. The footsteps behind him kept on coming. He stayed close to the buildings, where the shadows were deepest. A door opened in the darkness ahead. A hand grabbed his arm and pulled him inside. Chapter 14. The door closed again softly, and 3 seconds later the footsteps clattered by outside, at a slow and wary jog. Then silence came back. The hand on Reacher's arm pulled him deeper into darkness. Small fingers, but strong. They passed into a different space, a different acoustic, a different smell, a different room. He heard the scrabble of fingertips, searching for a light switch on a wall. The light came on. He blinked. The waitress. Watch where I go. An alley, not a doorway. Or an alley leading to a doorway. An alley leading to a doorway with a door left open a tempting inch. You live here? He asked. Yes, she said. She was still dressed for work. Black denim pants, black button-up shirt, petite, gamine, short dark hair, eyes full of concern. Thank you, Reacher said, for inviting me in. I tried to think what kind of tip I would like, she said, if I was a stranger the doorman was looking at sideways. Was he? You must have stirred something up. He didn't answer. The room they were in was a cozy space with muted colors, full of worn and comfortable items, some of them maybe from the pawn shop, cleaned and fixed up, and some of them bolted together from the remains of old industrial components. The frame from some kind of an old machine held up the coffee table, same kind of thing with a bookshelf, and so on. Repurposing, it was called. He had read about it in a magazine. He liked the style. He liked the result. It was a nice room. Then he heard a voice in his head. Be a shame if anything happened to it. You work for them, he said. You shouldn't be offering me refuge. I don't work for them, she said. I work for the couple who own the bar. The guy on the door is the cost of doing business. It would be the same wherever I worked. He seemed to think he could boss you around. They all do. Part of inviting you in is paying them back. Thank you, he said again. You're welcome. I'm Jack Reacher, he said. I'm very pleased to meet you. Abigail Gibson, she said. People call me Abby. People call me Reacher. She said, I'm very pleased to meet you, Reacher. They shook hands, quite formally. Small fingers, but strong. He said, I stirred it up on purpose. I wanted to see if and how fast and how hard they would react to something. What something? The name Maxim Trulenko. You ever heard of him? Sure, Abby said. He just went bankrupt. Some kind of dot-com bust. He was famous here for a spell. I want to find him. Why? He owes people money. Are you a debt collector? You told me you were out of work. Pro bono, Reacher said. Temporary. For an old couple I met. So far, exploratory only. Just a toe in the water. Doesn't matter if he owes people money. He hasn't got any. He's bankrupt. There's a theory he hid some private cash under his mattress. There's always a theory like that. I think in this case it might be right. Purely as a logical proposition. If he was broke, he would have been found by now. But he hasn't been found by now. Therefore, he can't be broke. Because the only way not to be found by now is to pay the Ukrainians to hide him, which requires money. Therefore, he still has some. If I find him soon, there might be some left. For your old couple. Hopefully enough to cover their needs. The only way not to be found is not to be broke, she said. Sounds like something out of a fortune cookie. But I guess they proved it was true tonight. Reacher nodded. 2 cars, he said. 4 guys. He's getting good value.
You shouldn't mess with these people, Abby said. I've seen them up close.
You're messing with them. You opened your door.
That's different. They'll never know. There are 100 doors.
He said, Why did you open your door?
You know why, she said.
Maybe they just wanted a cozy chat.
I don't think so.
Maybe all I would have gotten was a stern talking to. She didn't answer. You knew they wanted worse than that, he said. That's why you opened your door.
I've seen them up close, she said again.
What would they have done?
They don't like people getting in their business, she said. I think they would have messed you up bad.
Have you seen that kind of thing happen before?
She didn't answer.
Anyway, Reacher said, thanks again.
You need anything?
I should get going. You've done enough for me already. I have a hotel room.
Where?
He told her.
She shook her head. That's west of Center, she said. They have eyes in there. The texts will have already gone out with your description.
They seem to be taking it very seriously.
I told you, she said.
They don't like people in their business. How many of them are there?
Enough, she said. I was going to make coffee. You want some?
Sure, Reacher said. She led the way to her kitchen, which was small and mismatched, but clean and tidy. It felt like home. She knocked old grounds out of a filter basket and rinsed a pot and set the whole thing going. It burped and slurped and filled the room with a rich aroma.
I guess it doesn't keep you awake, Reacher said.
This is my evening time, she said. I go to bed when the sun comes up. Then I sleep all day.
Makes sense.
She opened a wall cupboard and took down 2 white china mugs.
I'm going to take a shower, she said. Help yourself if it's ready before I am.
A minute later, he heard running water, and after that, the gentle whine of a hairdryer. The coffee machine tinkled and sputtered. Abby got back just as it finished. She looked pink and damp, and she smelled of soap. She was wearing a knee-length dress that looked like a man's button-down shirt, but longer and slimmer. Probably not a whole lot underneath it. Certainly her feet were bare. After work attire. A cozy evening at home. They poured their coffee and took their mugs back to the living room.
You didn't answer my question, she said. I guess you didn't get a chance.
What question? He said.
What kind of work do you like to do?
In response, he gave her his capsule bio. Easy to understand at first, then harder later. Son of a Marine, childhood in 50 different places, then West Point, then the military police in 100 different places, then the reductions in force when the Cold War ended, leading directly to his sudden head-first introduction to civilian life. A straightforward story, followed by the wandering, which was not so straightforward. No job, no home, always restless, always moving. Just the clothes on his back, no particular place to go, and all the time in the world to get there. Some people found it hard to understand, but Abby seemed to get it. She asked none of the usual dumb questions. Her own story was shorter, because she was younger. Born in a suburb in Michigan, raised in a suburb in California, loved books and philosophy and theater and music and dance and experiment and performance art. Came to town as an undergraduate student and never left. A temporary gig waiting tables for a month turned into 10 years. She was 32. Older than she looked. She said she was happy. They went back and forth to the kitchen for refills of coffee and ended up facing each other at opposite ends of the sofa, Reacher sprawling comfortably, Abby sitting cross-legged, with the tails of her shirt dress tucked down demurely between her bare knees. Reacher didn't know much about philosophy or theater or dance or experiment or performance art, but he read books when he could, and he heard music when he could, so he was able to keep up. A couple of times they found they had read the same stuff. Same with music. She called it her retro phase. He said it felt like yesterday. They laughed about it. It got to 2 o'clock in the morning.
He figured he could get a room at an Albanian hotel, one block further east, just as good. He could afford to waste what he had already laid out. He was more annoyed about the 5 minutes of his life at the desk. He would never get that back. Abby said, "You can stay here, if you like." He was pretty certain there was one more button undone than before on the front of her shirt dress. He felt he could trust his judgment on the matter. He was an observant man. He had previously inspected the original gap many times. It had been very appealing. But the new gap was better. He said, "I didn't see a guest room." She said, "I don't have one." Would this be a lifestyle experiment? As opposed to what? Normal reasons. "I guess a mixture." "Works for me," Reacher said. Chapter 15. Dino's two guys were simply missing all night. From the liquor store onward, not a trace. Their phones were dead. No one had seen their car. They had disappeared into thin air, which of course was impossible. But still, no one woke Dino. A small-scale search was mounted instead, all the likely neighborhoods. No results. The two guys stayed missing. Until 7 o'clock in the morning, right there on their own property, when a guy stacking lumber with a forklift in a side yard backed up and found them, behind the last of the 10x2 cedar. Then they woke Dino. The side yard was separated from direct contractor access by a wire fence 8 feet high. The two guys had been hung upside down from the top of the fence. They had been slit open. Gravity had tumbled their guts out, on their chests, on their faces, on the ground beneath them. After death, happily. They both had crusted gunshot wounds. One had his head mostly gone. No sign of their car. No tracks. No nothing. Dino called a meeting in the back office boardroom, just 50 yards from the gruesome discovery, like a battlefield general, on hand to examine the terrain up close. He said, "Gregory must be out of his mind. We were the original victims here. We got the short end of every stick, and now he wants to rub it in by making it 4 for 2 as well? That's bullshit. How lopsided does he want it to get? What the hell is he thinking?" "But why so nasty?" his right-hand man said. "Why all the drama with their intestines hanging out? Surely that's the key to this thing." "Is it?" "Got to be. It was already gratuitous. This was unnecessary. Like they were mad at us. Like revenge for something. As if we had gotten the better of them somehow." "Well, we didn't." "Maybe there's something we don't know. Maybe we actually did get the better of them somehow. But we haven't caught on to it yet." "Caught on to what?" "We don't know yet. That's the point. All we got is the restaurant block. So maybe it's special in some way. Maybe it's a good producer. Maybe we get better access to people. All the bigwigs must eat there, with their wives and so on. Where else would they go?" Dino didn't answer. His guy said, "Why else would they get so angry?" Still, Dino didn't answer. Then he said, "Maybe you're right. Maybe the restaurant block is worth more than the money lending. I sincerely hope so. We got lucky. They got resentful. But whatever. 4 for 2 is bullshit. We can't live with that. Put the word out. Level the score by sunset." Reacher woke at 8 in the morning. Warm, relaxed, peaceful, partially entwined with Abby, who slept on undisturbed. She was tiny beside him. She was more than a foot shorter and less than half his weight. In repose, she was soft and boneless. In motion, she had been hard and lithe and strong, and certainly experimental. Her performance had been an art. That was for damn sure. He was a lucky man. He breathed deep and gazed up at the unfamiliar ceiling. It had cracks in the plaster, like a river system, painted over many times, like healed scars. He disentangled himself gently and slid out of bed and padded naked to the bathroom, and then to the kitchen, where he set the coffee going. He went back to the bathroom and took a shower, and then he collected his clothes from all over the living room, and he got dressed. He took a third white china mug from the wall cabinet and poured his first cup of the day. He sat at a tiny table in the window. The sky was blue, and the sun was up. It was a beautiful morning. Faint sounds came in, traffic and voices, people hustling and bustling, going to work, starting their day. He got up and got a refill and sat back down again. A minute later, Abby came in, naked, yawning, stretching, smiling. She took coffee and padded across the kitchen and sat in his lap, naked, soft, warm, and fragrant. What was a guy to do? A minute later, they were back in bed. Even better than the first time. Experimental all around. 20 whole minutes, soup to nuts. Afterward, they fell back, gasping and panting. He thought, not bad for an old guy. She snuggled against his chest, spent, breathing hard. He sensed the physical release in her, some kind of bone-deep animal satisfaction. But something else also, something more. She felt safe. She felt safe and warm and protected. She was luxuriating in it. She was celebrating the fact she was feeling it. Last night, he said, in the bar, when I asked you about the guy in the door, you asked me if I was a cop. You are a cop, she murmured. Was a cop, he said. Close enough for a first impression. I'm sure it's a look you never lose. Did you want me to be a cop? Were you hoping I was? Why would I be? Because of the guy in the door. Maybe you thought I could do something about him. No, she said. Hoping would have been a waste of time. The cops don't do anything about those guys. Never. Too much hassle. Too much money changing hands. Those guys are pretty much safe from the cops, believe me. Old disappointments in her voice. As an experiment, he asked, would you have liked it if I could have done something about him? She snuggled tighter. Unconsciously, he thought, which he figured had to mean something. She said, that particular guy? He was the one in front of me. She paused a beat. Yes, she said, I would have liked it. What would you have liked me to do to him? He felt her stiffen against him. She said, I guess I would have liked you to mess him up. Bad? Real bad. What have you got against him? She wouldn't answer. After a minute, he said, there was something else you mentioned last night. You said texts would have gone out with my description. As soon as they realized they lost you. To hotels and such. To everybody. That's how they do it now. They have automated systems. They're very good at technology. They're very advanced with computers. They're always trying new scams. Sending out an automatic all-points bulletin is easy in comparison. And literally everyone gets the same alert. Who are you thinking of in particular? Potentially, a guy in a different division, in the money lending section. Would that be a problem? He has a photograph of me, a close-up of my face. He'll recognize the description, and he'll text the picture in response. She snuggled closer, relaxed again. Doesn't really matter, she said. They're all out looking for you anyway. Your description is more than enough. A photograph of your face doesn't add much, not from a distance. That's not the problem. What is? The money-lending guy thinks my name is Aaron Shevick. Why? The Sheviks are my old couple. I did some business on their behalf. It seemed like a good idea at the time. But now the wrong name is out there. They could dig for an address. I wouldn't want them showing up at the Shevik house looking for me. That could lead to all kinds of unpleasantness. The Sheviks have enough on their plates already.
Where do they live?
Halfway to the eastern city limit, in an old post-war development.
That's Albanian territory.
It would be a very big deal for the Ukrainians to go there. They already took over their money-lending bar, Reacher said. That was way east of center. The battle lines seem relatively fluid right now. Abby nodded sleepily against his chest.
I know, she said. They all agree they can't have a war because of the new police commissioner. But all kinds of things seem to be happening.
Then she took a deep breath and held it and sat up and shook herself awake and said,
We should go now.
Where? Reacher asked.
We should go make sure your old couple is okay.
Abby had a car. It was parked in a garage a block away. It was a small white Toyota sedan with a stick shift and no hubcaps, plus electrical ties holding on one of the fenders, plus a crack in the windshield that made the view out front look like two overlapping halves. But the engine started, and the wheels steered, and the brakes worked. The glass in the windows was plain, not tinted, and Reacher felt his face was close to it, clearly visible to those outside, crammed as he was in a cramped interior. He watched for town cars, like he had crashed at the Ford dealer, and seen the night before coming at him north and south on the street. But he saw none at all, and no pale men in dark suits either, loitering on corners, watching. They drove the same way he had walked, past the bus depot, through the light, into the narrower streets, past the bar, and out again to the wider spaces. The gas station with the deli counter was up ahead. Pull in there, Reacher said. We should take them some food.
Are they okay with that?
Does it matter? They gotta eat.
She pulled in.
The menu was the same. Chicken salad or tuna salad. He got two of each, plus chips, plus soda, plus a can of coffee. Quitting eating was one thing. Coffee was a whole different thing entirely. They drove into the development and worked their way around the tight right-angle turns to the cul-de-sac near its center. They parked by the picket fence, with its nudging rosebuds.
This is it, Abby said.
Owned by the bank now, Reacher said.
Because of Max Trelenko.
And some well-meaning mistakes.
Will they be able to get it back from the bank?
I don't know much about that kind of stuff. But I don't see why not. It's all money and assets moving back and forth, buying and selling. I don't see why a bank would want to get in the way of a thing like that. I'm sure somehow it could find a way to turn a profit on the deal. They walked up the narrow concrete path. The door opened before they got to it. Aaron Shevik stood there. He had a worried look on his face.
Maria has disappeared, he said. I can't find her anywhere.
Chapter 16.
Aaron Shevik might have been a hotshot machinist in the distant past, but he was no kind of a useful witness in the present day. He said he had heard no traffic outside. He had seen no cars on the street. They had gotten up at 7 o'clock in the morning and had eaten a small breakfast at 8. Then he had walked to the convenience store to buy a quart of milk for future small breakfasts. When he got home, Maria was nowhere to be seen. How long were you gone? Reacher asked.
20 minutes, Shevik said. Maybe more. I'm still walking slow.
And you looked all through the house?
I thought maybe she had fallen. But she hadn't. Not in the yard either. So she went out somewhere. Or someone took her.
Let's start with she went out somewhere. Did she take her coat?
She didn't need her coat, Abby said. It's warm enough without. A better question would be, did she take her purse?
Shevik looked in what he called all the usual places. There were four of them. A particular spot on the kitchen countertop. A particular spot on an entryway bench in the hallway area opposite the front door. A particular peg in the coat closet where they also hung their umbrellas. And lastly, a spot on the living room floor next to her armchair. No purse. Okay, Reacher said. That's a good sign. Very persuasive. It means most likely she went out voluntarily, under her own steam, in an orderly fashion, not in any kind of panic, and not under any kind of duress. Shevik said, she might have left her purse somewhere else. He glanced all around, helpless. It was a small house, but even so, it hid 100 hiding places. Let's look on the bright side, Reacher said. She picked up her purse, she hooked it on her elbow, and she walked away down the path. Or they threw her in a car. Maybe they forced her to bring her purse. Maybe they knew how it would look to us. They're trying to throw us off the trail. I think she went to the pawn shop, Reacher said. Shevik was quiet a long moment. Then he raised a finger in a be right back kind of a way, and he limped down the corridor to the bedroom. A minute later, he limped back, carrying an ancient shoebox. It had faded pastel pink and white candy stripes on it, and a faded black and white label pasted to the short end, with a manufacturer's name, and a line drawing of a shoe, which was a proudly chunky woman's lace-up, and a size, which was 4, and a price, which was a penny shy of $4. Maybe the shoes Maria Shevik was married in. The family jewelry, Shevik said. He lifted the lid. The box was empty. No 9-carat wedding bands, no diamond engagement rings, no gold-plated watch with a crack in the crystal. We should go pick her up, Abby said. It will be a sad walk home otherwise. Organized crime's traditional staples were usury, narcotics, prostitution, gambling, and protection rackets. Throughout their half of the city, the Ukrainians ran them all with great skill and aplomb. Narcotics were doing better than ever. Weed had largely gone away because of creeping legalization all over the place, but exploding demand for meth and oxy more than made up the difference. Profit was sky high, pushed even higher by a percentage royalty on all the Mexican heroin sold in the city itself, from the western limit to Center Street. Every single gram. Gregory's greatest success. He had negotiated the deal himself. The Mexican gangs were notorious barbarians, and it took a lot to impress them. But Gregory had persisted. 2 of their street corner guys upside down with their guts out had finally done the trick. Before death, unhappily. At that point, the Mexicans had started to fear for future recruitment. Street corner guys didn't make much. Enough to risk getting shot, maybe, but not enough to risk getting hung upside down and slit wide open from throat to groin, while still alive. Hence the royalty. It kept everyone happy. Prostitution was doing fine, too, mostly because of what Gregory thought of as a built-in advantage. Ukrainian girls were very beautiful. Many of them were tall and slender and very blonde. None of them had any chance of advancement at home. In the old country, they had nothing ahead of them except a lifetime of mud and drudgery. No fine clothes, no high-rise apartments, no Mercedes-Benzes. They knew that. So they were happy to come to America. They understood the paperwork was complicated and the process expensive. They knew they would have to reimburse their helpers for the upfront outlay just as quickly as they could, and definitely before they moved on to whatever it was that came next, which would hopefully involve fine clothes and high-rise apartments and Mercedes-Benzes. They were told all of that was coming soon. But first, there would be a brief period of employment. Only afterward would they get access to all those glittering opportunities. But not to worry. There was a system already in place. It was well organized. It was pleasant work. And very social, mostly just mixing with people, like public relations. They would enjoy it. They might even get a jump on meeting the right kind of guy. They were graded on arrival. Not that any of them was ugly. Gregory had a wide choice. There were always 100,000 ready to jump on a plane. They were all fresh and flawless and fragrant. Surprisingly, the most valued were not the youngest. Not at the top end of the market. Certainly there were plenty of guys willing to pay to get blown by kids younger than their granddaughters, but experience showed the guys with the really big bucks found that kind of extreme a little creepy. Experience showed such a guy preferred a slightly older woman, maybe even 27 or 28, with a faint air of sophistication and worldliness about her, with a hint of approaching maturity, maybe a smile line or two, so he wouldn't feel like a molester, so he would feel like he had a junior colleague in his room, maybe a rising executive, seeking advice or a raise or a promotion, any or all of which she might get, if she played her cards right. Such a woman usually stayed about 5 years in that role. Somehow, she never made it to the fine clothes and the high-rise apartments and the Mercedes-Benzes. Somehow, she never quite paid off her debt. No one had thought about interest rates. Sometimes, such a woman would do another 5 years, if she was wearing well, on the mature page of the website. And if she wasn't wearing well, then her price would be dropped a couple $100 an hour, and she would soldier on as well as she could, for as long as she could. After that, she would be taken off the website altogether and sent to one of their many backstreet massage parlors, where the shortest appointment was 20 minutes, and where she would be dressed in an abbreviated version of a nurse's uniform and rubber gloves, and put to work 16 hours a day. Each such parlor was managed by a parlor boss, who was assisted by a deputy parlor boss. Like the women who worked under them, they were generally not the pick of the litter. But on the plus side, their job was very straightforward. They had only three tasks. They had to deliver a set number of dollars every week. They had to maintain enthusiasm among their staff. They had to maintain order among their customers. That was it. Such a specification attracted a particular type of candidate. Nasty enough to get the dollars, tough enough to subdue the customers, bent enough to enjoy the staff. At one particular parlor 2 blocks west of center, their names were Bodan and Artam. Bodan was the boss. Artam was the deputy. So far, their day was going well. They had gotten a text about a guy to be on the lookout for, with a brief verbal description, mostly about his size and weight, both of which seemed impressive. They had scrutinized their stream of customers. No such guy. But plenty of other guys. So far, all well-behaved, all satisfied. No issues with staff, either, beyond a small thing in the morning when one of the older ones was late, and then not sufficiently apologetic about it. She was offered a choice of forfeits. She chose the leather paddle as soon as she came off duty. Bodan would administer the punishment, and Artam would video it. It would be on their porn sites an hour later. It might have earned a few bucks by the morning. A win-win. All good. So far, their day was going well. Then 2 customers came in who looked different. Darkish hair, darkish skin, sunglasses, short dark raincoats, black jeans. Almost like a uniform. Which happened. Mostly because of the university. There were all kinds of folks in town. Mostly they dressed like where they came from. Hence these 2. Maybe they were scholars visiting from overseas. Maybe they were sampling the illicit charms of their host nation purely for research, purely to achieve a better mutual understanding. Or not. They pulled matching guns out from under their matching coats, 2 H&K MP5 submachine guns with integral suppressors. By coincidence, the same brand and the same model the Ukrainians themselves had used the night before outside the liquor store. Small world. The 2 guys gestured at Bodan and Artam to stand together, side by side, shoulder to shoulder. They each fired a round into the floor to show their guns were silenced. 2 spitting bangs, loud, but not loud enough to bring someone running. They said in bad Ukrainian, with heavy Albanian accents, that they were offering a choice. There was a car outside, and Bodan and Artam could go get in it, or they could get gut shot right there, right then, with the guns just proved quiet enough to bring no one running. They could bleed to death on the floor, 20 minutes of agony, and then they could get dragged out by the heels and put in the car anyway. Their choice. Bodan didn't answer. Not right away. Neither did Artan. They were genuinely uncertain. They had heard about Albanian torments. Maybe getting gut shot was better. They said nothing. The building was silent. Not a sound. The massage cubicles were all in a line, on a long corridor, the other side of a closed inner door. The front of house area could have been a lawyer's waiting room, some kind of under-the-table compromise with the city. Out of sight, out of mind. Don't frighten the voters. Gregory had done the deal. Then the silence was broken. There was a sound, the faint click of heels in the inner corridor. Tap, tap, tap. 5-inch spikes, like they all had to wear. Clear plastic, sometimes. Stripper shoes. The Americans had a word for everything. Tap, tap, tap. One of them was moving, maybe from the restroom back to her cubicle, or from one cubicle to another, from one client to the next. Some girls were popular. Some got requests. The heels kept on coming. Tap, tap, tap. Maybe she was headed for a cubicle all the way up front. Tap, tap, tap. The inner door opened. A woman stepped through. Bodan saw it was one of the older ones. In fact, the one due to get the paddle when she came off duty. Like all of them, she was half wearing a half-size shiny white latex version of a nurse's uniform, complete with a little white cap pinned up top. The hem of her skirt rode 6 inches higher than the tops of her stockings. She raised her hand, one finger vaguely ahead of the others, like people do, simultaneously as an apology for an interruption and the introduction of a question. She never got there. Whatever mundane issue was on her mind remained unexpressed. More towels, more lotion, new rubber gloves, whatever it was. The door swinging open was in the left corner of the left-hand guy's eye, and he fired instantly, a neat, quiet stitch of 3 into her center mass. No reason for it. Some kind of hyperstate, some kind of fever pitch. A twitch of the muzzle, a twitch of the trigger finger. There was no echo, just a long, ragged, plastic, fleshy thump as the woman went down. Bodan said, "Jesus Christ." It changed the argument. Getting gutshot was no longer a theory. Visual aids had been introduced. Ancient human instinct took over. Stay alive a minute longer. See what happens next. They got in the car voluntarily. By chance, they crossed Center Street and entered Albanian territory at the exact same moment the woman in the nurse costume died. She was alone on the floor of the parlor, half in and half out of the back corridor. All the clients had fled. They had jumped over her and run. Likewise her co-workers. They had all done the same thing. They were all gone. She died alone, in pain, uncomforted and unconsoled. Her name was Anna Ulyana Doroshkin. She was 41 years old. She had first come to the city 15 years earlier, at the age of 26, all excited about a career in PR. Chapter 17. Aaron Shevik didn't know exactly where the city's pawn shops were. Reacher's guess was they would be somewhere on the same radius as the bus depot, at a discreet distance from the fancy neighborhoods. He knew cities. There would be low-rent enterprises packed tight throughout the outlying blocks. There would be window tinting and laundromats and dusty old mom-and-pop hardware stores and off-brand auto parts. And pawn shops. The problem was planning a route. They wanted to be able to pick Mrs. Shevik up if she had already done her business and was already walking home. Not knowing her destination made that difficult. In response, they drove wide loops, finding a pawn shop, checking inside through the window, not seeing her, setting out home until they were sure she couldn't still be ahead of them, and then driving back and starting over with the next place they saw. In the end, they found her all the way west of center, stepping out of a grimy pawn shop across a narrow street from a taxi dispatcher and a bail bond office. Mrs. Shevick, right there, large as life, head up, her purse hooked on her elbow. Abby pulled over next to her, and Aaron wound down his window and called out to her. She was very surprised to see him, but she got over it fast. She got right in the car, less than 10 seconds beginning to end, like it had been arranged in advance. She was embarrassed at first, in front of Abby, a stranger. "You must think us very foolish." Aaron asked her how much she had gotten for the rings and the watch, and she just shook her head and wouldn't answer. Then eventually she said, $80. No one spoke. They drove back east, past the depot, through the four-way light. At that moment, in his office, Gregory was getting the news about his massage parlor. By chance, another of his guys had been passing by on unrelated business. He had sensed something wrong. Too quiet. He had gone inside. The place was completely deserted. Nothing but an old hooker shot dead on the floor in a big pool of blood. No one else. No clients. Apparently all the other hookers had run away. There was no trace of Bodan or Artam. Artam's phone was lying on his desk, and Bodan's jacket was still on the back of his chair. Not good signs. They meant they had not left the premises voluntarily. They meant they had left under some kind of duress. Gregory called his top boys together. He told them the facts. Then he told them to think hard for 60 seconds and come up with first an analysis of what the hell was going on, and second, what the hell to do about it. His right-hand man spoke first.
"This is Dino's doing," he said. "I think we all know that. He's a man on a mission. We took two of his guys with the trick about the spy in the police station, so he took two of ours up at the Ford dealer, which was fair. Can't dispute it. What goes around comes around. Except, evidently, he didn't like losing the loan business, so he decided to punish us by taking two more of our guys on the restaurant block. So we took two more of his outside the liquor store last night, which was then 4 for 4. A fair exchange. End of story. Except apparently Dino doesn't agree. Apparently he feels he has a point to make. Perhaps an ego thing. He wants to be two guys ahead at all times. Perhaps it makes him feel better. So now he's made it 6 for 4. What should we do about it? Gregory asked. His guy was quiet for a very long time. Then he said, "We didn't get where we are by being stupid. If we make it 6 for 6, he'll make it 8 for 6, and so on, forever. It will be a slow-motion war. We can't get into a war right now. So what should we do?" "We should suck it up. We're down two guys and the restaurant block, but we got the loan business instead. Overall, we came out ahead." Gregory said, "Makes us look weak." "No," his guy said, "it makes us look like the grown-ups playing the long game with our eyes on the prize. We're down two men. It's humiliating. If a week ago Dino had offered to trade all of his loan business for two of our men and the restaurant block, we would have bitten his hand off. We came out way ahead. Dino is humiliated, not us." "It feels weird just to leave it." "No," his guy said again. "It feels smart. We're playing chess here, and right now we're winning." "What will they do to our guys?" "Nothing pleasant, I'm sure." No one spoke for a minute. Then Gregory said, "We need to find the hookers. Can't let them run away. Bad for discipline. We're on it,
someone said. Silence again. Then Gregory's phone rang. He answered and listened and hung up. He looked straight at his right-hand man. He smiled.
Maybe you're right, he said. Maybe having the loan business puts us ahead.
How so? His guy asked.
Now we have a name, Gregory said, and a photograph. The guy who asked about Max Trolenko last night is called Aaron Shevik. He's a customer. Currently, he owes us $25,000. We're working on getting his address. Apparently, he's a big, ugly son of a bitch.
Abby parked on the curb next to the picket fence, and they all got out and walked up the narrow concrete path. Maria Shevik took her keys from the purse on her elbow and unlocked the door. They went inside. Maria saw the can of coffee on the kitchen counter.
Thank you, she said.
Pure self-interest, Reacher said back.
You want some?
I thought you'd never ask. Maria opened the can and set the machine going. She joined Abby in the living room. Abby was looking at the photographs on the wall. She asked quietly, gently,
What's the latest news on Meg?
It's a brutal treatment, Maria said.
She's in a special isolation unit. Either out of her mind on painkillers or fast asleep, because they sedate her. We can't visit. We can't even talk on the phone.
That's awful.
But the doctors are optimistic, Maria said. So far, anyway. We'll know more soon. They'll do another scan before long.
If we pay for it first, her husband said.
6 chances before the week is over, Reacher thought. He said, We think Meg's old boss is still in town. We think he still has money. Your lawyers reckon the best strategy is to sue him direct. Absolutely can't fail, they said.
Where is he?
Shevik asked. We don't know yet.
Can you find him?
Probably, Reacher said. That kind of thing used to be part of my job.
The law moves slow, Maria said. Like she had once before.
They ate the lunch from the gas station deli, in the living room, because the kitchen had only 3 chairs. Abby sat cross-legged on the floor where the TV used to be and ate off her lap. Maria Shevik asked her what she did for a living. Abby told her. Aaron talked about the good old days before computer-controlled machine tools, when everything was cut by eye and feel to 1/1000th of an inch. They could make anything, American workers, once the greatest natural resource in the world. Now look what happened. A crying shame.
Reacher heard a car in the street, the soft hiss and squelch of a big sedan.
He got up and stepped into the hallway and looked out the window. A black Lincoln Town Car. 2 guys in it. Pale faces, fair hair, white necks. They were trying to turn the car around, back and forth. Back and forth, across the narrow width. They wanted to be facing in the right direction. For a fast getaway, perhaps. Abby's Toyota didn't help. It was in the way. Reacher went back to the living room. He said, They figured out Aaron Shevik's address.
Abby stood up.
Maria said,
They're here?
Because someone sent them, Reacher said. That's the thing we have to remember. We've got about 30 seconds to figure this out. Whoever sent them knows where they are. If anything happens to them, this house becomes ground zero for retribution. We should try to avoid that if possible. If we were somewhere else, no problem, but not here.
Shevik said, So what do we do?
Get rid of them.
Me?
Any of you. Just not me. I'm the one they think is Aaron Shevik. There was a knock at the door.
Chapter 18.
There was a second knock at the door. No one moved. Then Abby took a step, but Maria put a hand on her arm and Aaron went instead. Reacher ducked into the kitchen and sat there, listening. He heard the door open, and then a missed beat from the step. Just silence, as if the two guys were momentarily set back by the fact that the man who had opened the door was not the man they were looking for. One of them said, "We need to speak with Mr. Aaron Shevik." Mr. Aaron Shevik said, "Who?" "Aaron Shevik. I think he was the last tenant." "You rent here?" "I'm retired. Too expensive to buy." "Who's your landlord?" "A bank." "What's your name?" "I'm not sure I want to tell you that until you state your business." "Our business is private. With Mr. Shevik alone. It's a very sensitive matter." "Wait a minute," Shevik said. "Are you from the government?" No answer. "Or the insurance fund?" One of the two guys said, "What's your name, old man?"